Seats are going quickly. Find a seat. Welcome to our second panel today, which will focus on naval war. And my name is Leanne Weitz, and I will do the introductions. And I will just introduce all of the paper givers at once, and then I will introduce our commenter. So, sitting at the far end, we have Laura June Davis, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Georgia. Her dissertation is entitled Vexed Waters, Confederate Naval Warfare Along the Lower Mississippi, 1861 to 1865. Her paper today, which I assume is drawn from the larger work of your dissertation, is entitled Devils in Disguise, Masculinity and Irregular Naval War Along the Lower Mississippi. And sitting next to her, we have Robert Gummistead. He has his doctorate from Louisiana State University. He's currently an associate professor at Colorado State University. His publications include A Troublesome Commerce, The Transformation of the Interstate Slave Trade and Steamboats on the Rise of the Cotton Kingdom. His paper today is entitled The Hard Hand of War on the Western Waters. And finally, last but not least, in the bow tie, we have Lakeney K. Hill, who is a doctoral candidate at Texas Christian University. His paper today is entitled A Hard Blockade, the Union Navy, and the Foundations of Hard War Policy. So I think that we could just go in the order that I just announced. So Laura June Davis.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you all for being here. And this is the perfect room for me to give this talk, since I like to talk about steamboat explosions. So just picture everything on the wall blowing up, and that's kind of the background for what I'm talking about. Within weeks of the first volley at Fort Sumter, New Orleans bore witness to an altogether different salvo. On May 6, 1861, the docks at Algiers, Louisiana, ignited into flames. 9 commercial steamboats, the General Pike, Editor, Granada, Telegram, Baltic, Republic, Madison, Dolly Webb, and Conqueror mysteriously caught fire. In a matter of moments, over 4,500 tons of timber splintered into kindling, and the combined investment of $28,500 disintegrated into ash. Yet the event was unremarkable. Despite the magnitude of such a multi-vessel conflagration, the inferno drew little local interest or concern. After all, steamboat fires, usually attributed to boiler explosions, were fairly common in the 19th century. On average, 21% of all antebellum riverboats burned or exploded. Between 1847 and 1857 alone, 230 steamboats caught fire. Between 1816 and 1848, 1,433 people lost their lives in riverboat explosions. As citizens of a prominent port town, New Orleanians would have been cognizant of the innate danger and combustibility of steamboats. As such, local officials dismissed the incident as an accident, signifying that the notion of intentional boat burning had not yet entered into the public consciousness. Interestingly, though, at least one party thought this 1861 New Orleans inferno was intentional. The Cincinnati Daily Press reported that the fire was the work of, quote, a Negro incendiary, end quote. Whether the newspaper meant that the culprit was an African American, an abolitionist Republican, or simply a degenerate was unclear. What was apparent was that the paper's declaration that the steamboat burnings were the act of deliberate sabotage. The veracity of such an allegation remains unknown, but it was definitely a portent of things to come. While locals quickly dismissed the 1861 New Orleans conflagration as an accident, by war's end, Union officials deemed all Mississippi River steamboat fires to be the act of sabotage. As early as October 1863, Union Army Chief Quartermaster Robert Allen declared, quote, that there are disloyal men in disguise in the employ of every steamer, and it will be difficult to eliminate them, end quote. After the war, unsubstantiated newspaper reports claimed that over 200 steamboats along the lower Mississippi River, so St. Louis to New Orleans, fell victim to Confederate boat burners during the Civil War. While exaggerated, official reports have only deemed about 60 steamboat fires to be the cause of rebel incendiaries, these reports signify a drastic change in public perception. During the latter half of the war, a small but vicious group of rebel incendiaries operated along the lower Mississippi River, wreaking havoc and invoking fear along their fiery course. While not mainstream sailors, boat burners did in fact take their cause to the water, making steamships and river ports their battlefields of choice. Referred to as incendiaries or naval guerrillas by their contemporaries, boat burners markedly differed from bushwhackers or partisan rangers. While irregular fighters such as William Cantrell and Bloody Bill Anderson flaunted their exploits, naval guerrillas intentionally operated in the shadows. They skulked along the docks. They secreted themselves aboard vessels, or they insinuated themselves as steamboat crew members. Shock and awe may have been their aims, but secrecy and terror were their watchwords of choice. And while the boat burners may not have been guerrillas in the conventional context, it is important to note that the contemporaries classified them as such. This I will often interchangeably refer to them as boat burners, incendiaries, or naval guerrillas, the terms that their 19th century peers ascribed to them. One striking feature of the naval guerrillas was their definition of masculinity. By operating on the periphery of the conventional war, rebel incendiaries embodied a unique form of manhood, distinct from their enlisted or bushwhacking brethren. The boat burners redefined conventional notions of martial manhood to accommodate their seemingly savage, nefarious, and cowardly actions. They cast themselves as patriotic warriors taking explosive action. As J.W. Tucker explained, quote, "I feel as intensely as it is possible to feel the vital necessity of striking hard blows now and striking them as many points and in as many ways as possible so as to aid our cause and save our country. I propose to destroy our enemies' transports, arsenals, navy yards, stores, etc." End quote. Tucker and his fellow saboteurs firmly believed that their aggressive tactics were in the service of the Confederate cause and that they were legitimate combatants. While contemporaries may have labeled them as spineless for skulking along the shadows in the dead of night, setting fire to vessels, sneaking away, and never taking credit for their actions, they likely did not. Instead, they undoubtedly cast their own behavior as inventive and utilitarian. They did whatever was necessary, no matter the cost to their reputation, for the sake of the Confederate cause. Thus, the rebel incendiaries embodied a definition of masculinity that embraced aggression and ingenuity at the cost of chivalry and fame. If W.E.B. Du Bois was correct in his assertion that only murder makes the man, then the naval guerrillas were certainly men. Nearly 70 people died at the hands of an organized gang of boat burners operating out of St. Louis. For example, on July 15, 1864, the Cherokee's Porter died during a multi-vessel conflagration in St. Louis. The August 4, 1863 burning of the Ruth resulted in the deaths of 26 people, including a Union paymaster, 3 Yankee clerks, 1 woman, and 3 Negroes. And you guys have information about that upstairs if you want to learn more. Most of the casualties were drowning victims who fell into the water when the ship's plank collapsed onto the deck. And the 40-odd victims of the Robert Campbell Jr. Inferno, which was September 28, 1864, included 4 federal soldiers, 2 children, and an invalid woman. The total number of deaths attributable to naval guerrillas is unknown, but likely in the hundreds. The naval guerrillas were not altogether different from their filibuster forefathers described by historian Amy Greenberg. These rebel incendiaries, too, reveled in their physical strength and ability to dominate both men and women and believed that the masculine qualities of strength, aggression, and even violence better defined a true man. They embodied the ideals of bravery, adventure, and bellicosity. The boat burners simply chose to challenge Union control and assert their dominance via fire, terror, and secrecy. In fact, their choice to inflame violence, literally and figuratively, harkened back to an age-old tradition of the marginalized to use arson for revenge against injury or injustice. Thus, naval guerrillas redefined martial manhood to accommodate their inflammatory aims and furtive tactics. In many ways, they were able to pursue such fiery exploits because of their martial manhood. Unlike their enlisted counterparts, the boat burners did not have to adhere to the demands or constraints of a conventional army or navy. As there were no officers to report to, the rebel incendiaries need not worry about a superior's demands, bourgeoisie values, or preponderance for disciplinary action. The naval guerrillas therefore enjoyed remarkable freedom in both their operations and fields of combat. They did not suffer the strained manhoods required of the gentlemen in the roughs. Such deliberation allowed the Confederate boat burners to skirt conventional rules of combat, yet they did show restraint of a different sort. They never sought publicity or celebrity for their actions. Instead, they preferred to operate in secret, evoking fear through their omnipresence and anonymity. While not braggarts, the rebel incendiaries were no less men or warriors than the Confederate sailors, partisan rangers, or Union soldiers they encountered. In sum, by preferring anonymity, the naval guerrillas succeeded in a stealthy game of subterfuge, targeting Union steamboats and setting them ablaze via fire or torpedo. They usually besieged merchant or civilian vessels rather than federal gunboats, exemplifying 19th century irregular guerre de course and terrorism. By targeting commercial vessels, naval guerrillas distracted the Federals from their primary objectives, caused them to alter strategies, injured the morale of Union troops, and forced the reassignment of men and resources to counter threats along the lower Mississippi River. As a result, the boat burners caused hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages, destroying the livelihoods of civilian steamboat owners, as well as vital war materiel destined for Union troops. The victimization of innocent women and children only worsened the incendiaries' crimes. In essence, naval guerrillas challenged the Union's control of the waterways, regularly denying Northerners complete freedom to use the river by mounting many small-scale attacks on steamers for the remainder of the war. Trying to paint a collective portrait of rebel boat burners is often a daunting task. Just as the lack of such official records as enlistment papers, muster rolls, and discharges makes it impossible to create a profile of the typical guerrilla, an official roster of naval guerrillas does not exist. Provost Marshal J.H. Baker did in fact provide Union officials with a list of 19 boat burners operating out of St. Louis, and the Judge Advocate General identified 35 people, including Jefferson Davis, as part of a boat burning conspiracy. But such registers emphasized organized gangs of naval guerrillas. They completely ignored or dismissed individual agents or small groups of incendiaries that operated along the river. Ultimately, historians must paint a collective portrait from old newspaper reports, provost marshal investigations, and official records, sources that so vilified the incendiaries it can be difficult to take their human measure. For example, newspapers cast the culprit of a July 15, 1864 inferno as, quote, some devil in the shape of a human being, end quote. And despite the imagery of fire and brimstone that blaming steamboats certainly evoked, this incendiary was no devil, but a man. They were all men. As naval guerrillas preferred shadows and secrecy, many remain lost from the historical record, yet a few profiles do emerge. Robert Loudon was one such incendiary. Standing at approximately 5'9", with dark hair, large blue eyes, and a lean build of 160 to 170 pounds, Loudon was a steamboat painter and pilot from St. Louis. During the war, Loudon was a mail runner, as was his wife Mary and good friend Absalom Grimes, and there are people in this room who could tell you far more about that than me, covertly transporting correspondence into Confederate territory. No doubt such work experience and connections aided Loudon in his fiery exploits. Familiar with the culture, language, and layouts of steamboats, he could have easily insinuated himself as a member of a crew and then set the fire to the ship. More than a dozen steamboat fires were attributed to Loudon and his co-conspirators. Furthermore, Loudon was a fixture within St. Louis's wharf culture, a frequent visitor to area bars and brothels. He likely plotted his nefarious machinations within their seedy walls. Establishments like Mrs. Kate Clark's House of Ill Repute, where Union officials captured Loudon, offered potential meeting places for Confederate sympathizers like the St. Louis boat burners and mail runners. While the exact role that the Soiled Doves played in the plot may never be known, evidence suggests that Loudon and other naval guerrillas tapped into St. Louis's underworld to ignite their explosive plans. Loudon's local connections and ties to rebel mail runners also aided in his effort to elude Union forces. In 1863, he snuck aboard the White Cloud in an effort to escape a federal mandated death sentence. The provost marshal eventually captured and imprisoned Loudon at Gratiot State Penitentiary in St. Louis. And General Orders 41 of 1864 sentenced him to death for his role in steamboat burning. But Loudon never saw the hangman's noose. He managed to escape prison and his execution by heading south to New Orleans. No subsequent action succeeded in recapturing him. According to Absalom Grimes, Loudon became a painter in Mobile, Alabama, before dying of yellow fever several years after the war. Described as a faithful friend by Grimes, Loudon purportedly, quote, had unlimited courage and judgment for any dangerous work, end quote. Yet the historical record vilified him. One newspaper cast him as surly, while the provost marshal characterized him as a villain with square shoulders, fair complexion, and large blue eyes, constantly rolling, which is my favorite part, who displayed a great deal of white fair hair and whiskers. If the rolling eyes are not dubious enough, reports claim that Loudon frequently wore a false mustache and backwards hat. Either marked signs of wickedness or a deliberate effort to mask his appearance and explosive intentions. In the post-war era, Loudon purportedly became the, quote, murderer of the age, end quote, as he allegedly made a deathbed confession to being the sinister agent behind the Sultana explosion. According to an 1888 St. Louis Globe Democrat article, Loudon supposedly told William Streeter, his former jailer, that, quote, a torpedo and a lump of coal was carried aboard the steamer at Memphis and deposited in the coal pile in front of the boilers for the express purpose of causing her destruction, end quote. As Loudon had a well-earned reputation for storytelling, heavy drinking, cavorting with prostitutes, few contemporaries believed him. The facts that the official federal investigation cited a faulty boiler as the explosion's cause, and that this supposed confession came two decades after the fact, also cast doubt on the veracity of such a statement. Is it in the realm of remote possibility? Sure. And the St. Louis Globe Democrat's willingness to print such rumors attested to the lingering fear that the boat burners generated even decades after the war had ended. Robert Loudon's colorful life sheds light on the shady dealings of naval guerrillas and their sense of martial manhood, operating out of bars and brothels, masking their appearances, setting fires in the dead of night, and choosing not to seek recognition at the time of action signified an embodiment of masculinity that was cunning, violent, and above all secretive. In essence, Loudon and his fellow incendiaries let their explosive actions speak for themselves. They internalized the notion of manhood that accommodated secrecy, celebrated getting one's hands dirty, highlighted a need to risk one's own life, and encouraged murder. They did whatever was necessary for the rebel cause, no matter the cost, and that was what made them martial men. Taking a broader look at naval guerrillas besides Robert Loudon, a general portrait does emerge. He was a Confederate sympathizer from a river town, St. Louis, New Orleans, Memphis, Mobile. He was a working man who did not directly benefit from slavery or the slave economy, although plantation owners and slave traders may have frequented his saloon, traveled aboard his steamship, or stayed in his lodgings. Certainly, steamboat workers carried slave-produced cotton, if not slaves themselves, aboard the ships. And we know between 1820 and 1860, the internal slave trade resulted in 1 million enslaved being sold downriver. He was most likely white, although at least one alleged boat burner was dark-skinned, and he may have been of Irish descent. And I should note, I have not found any female naval guerrillas, but the fact that some fires started in ladies' cabins and ships may suggest that they're there, but I have no proof that any females exist yet. I'm looking for them, though. Most importantly, he had strong ties to his communities, either by virtue of his position or his gregarious nature, that offered him a support network to aid in his nefarious activities and to hide away from Union authorities whenever necessary. While many naval guerrillas may have acted alone, some appear to have worked in small groups. In October of 1863, the 6th Iowa Cavalry captured three boat burners in Memphis. In December, a Secret Service agent arrested a pair of boat burners at the mouth of the White River. In July of the following year, two men faced trial for the contingent burnings of the Cherokee, E.F. Dix, Glasgow, Northerner, Sunshine, and Welcome. And such duos and trios were not surprising. In all practicality, one naval guerrilla likely stood watch while his partner or partners boarded the vessel to either set a fire or stow away an incendiary device. Their small numbers helped them to evade detection or public notice. Further evidence suggests that a gang of boat burners did in fact exist. William Murphy, a member of the organized incendiaries, gave a full confession to Provost Marshal J.H. Baker. According to Murphy, Edward Fraser led a band of 19 secret agents whose mission was to destroy federal property and steamboats. Murphy further confessed that they were employed by the rebel authorities and that the Confederate government endorsed their actions. He told officials that in exchange for destroying steamboats, the St. Louis boat burners were paid at Richmond by the rebel Secretary of State, and he also claimed to have enjoyed a private audience with Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Well, Provost Marshal Baker noted that, quote, it would be impossible to obtain a correct account of the property destroyed by these properties, end quote. He believed them to be responsible for the burning of at least 10 vessels, including the Catahoula, Champion, Chancellor, City of Madison, Forest Queen, Imperial, Hiawatha, Jesse K. Bell, Postboy, and Robert Campbell, Jr. By war's end, newspapers were reporting that, quote, the evidence filed by the Bureau of Military Justice against the gang of rebel incendiaries, who during the war combined amusement with business by burning steamboats and warehouses in the Southwest, implicates about 35 persons, end quote. And newspapers also elevated the damage caused by naval guerrillas, claiming that during the war, over 200 steamers of all kinds, valued anywhere from $15,060 to $150,000 each, were destroyed by this chivalrous band, involved not only an immense pecuniary to the government, but the sacrifice of hundreds of valuable lives. The elevated number of participants in sabotage vessels revealed the effectiveness of the naval guerrillas in invoking fear. Terrorists, their greatest accomplishment was convincing federal officials and local populations that their reach was much further than it actually was. Whether or not the naval guerrillas actually sabotaged 200 vessels is not important. The fact that the Union believed them to be agents of such whole destruction is. In the end, fear and terror were in fact the boat burners' greatest tools, and they were cognizant of these facts. A February 1865 letter to President Jefferson Davis shed light on the naval guerrillas' terroristic motivations. W.S. Oldham advised that the rebels should, quote, burn every transport and gunboat on the Mississippi River, as well as devastate the country of the enemy and fill his people with terror and consternation, end quote. Notably, all of this was done under the veil of maximum secrecy. The combination of such language and mystery suggested that the boat burners not only embraced terrorism, but utilized it to bolster their sense of martial manhood. They defined themselves in times of fiery actions rather than explosive words. They thrived on violence, chaos, and panic rather than on fame or celebrity. And they valued secrecy and anonymity because it ensured success, invoked fear, and convinced the Union of their comprehensive destruction. These devils in disguise were a new breed of enemy that challenged Yankee control over the Mississippi River and complicated 19th century notions of masculinity. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your attendance here, and this is a very inspiring room with all the steamboats in it. I have to confess that I'm such a steamboat nerd that the ringtone on my phone is Steamboat Willie. So I've silenced the phone, so you won't have to listen to that. The message from January 1863 was short and direct. Here it is in its entirety. Sir, when you arrive at Greenville, Mississippi, or the place where the vessels are fired upon, haul your vessel close to the bank where the men can work securely under your guns and cut the levee so that the whole country may be overflowed. If that succeeds, go to the other side of the point and do the same. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, David D. Porter. Porter's order to the commander of the timber-clad USS Tyler followed up a bundle of directives he had fired off earlier in the day. The Union had several types of vessels in its Western fleet, and it had three timberclads, which were essentially commercial steamboats, similar to the one on the model over there. Yes, thank you, Vanna. And they slathered them with these thick oak planks and kind of turned them into these floating forts, if you will. Powerful, but extraordinarily slow. Porter's first set of instructions were no less aggressive. Drive Confederate guerrillas away from Greenville, protect transports until past danger, fire on any white people congregating at the point, don't tie up along the bank, and if fired upon from the town, quote, try to set fire to it with your shells, end quote. The always controlling Porter added a proviso that Pritchett not waste any ammunition raising the town. The record is silent if Pritchard's men set fire to Greenville or if they were promiscuous in their use of shells, but it is almost certain that they pierced the levee. This small incident reveals much about a larger war. First, specific features of the natural and built environments became locations of particular violence. Confederate guerrillas gathered at the point because Union gunboats and transports were vulnerable as they slowed down to round the spit of land. But every good turn deserves another. Puncturing the levee was a way to use natural forces against Southern guerrillas and civilians. The landscape, whether relatively natural or dramatically modified by humans, became something to manipulate or to deploy against the enemy. Second, Both sides try to control access to and the production and distribution of the products of the land. For the Confederacy, sinking Union transports could deprive Northern soldiers of necessary calories. Northern boats destroyed key sections of the levee in order to flood valuable farmland and destroy Southern crops. The Union Navy also made huge efforts to tamp down the cross-Mississippi movement of supplies and shut down illegal trade along the Western waters. And finally, Confederate partisans provoked the Union Navy into reprisals that dragged civilians into the conflict. Setting fire to an entire town would certainly punish residents who did not support partisan activity, and it's suggestive of how frustrated the Navy had become by early 1863 in its attempt to shear off support for partisans. Thus, the Union's hard war was a consequence, at least in part, of this environmental struggle, and the Northern Brown Water Navy was crucial in making Southern civilians feel the hard hand of war. The Union's advance along the Western rivers is too well known to recount here, given the audience, but less well known is the logistical effort that supported these victories. The Union essentially commandeered or purchased hundreds of commercial steamboats and used them as transports along the Cumberland, Tennessee, Ohio, Mississippi rivers, etc. And the boats of the Mississippi Squadron, a disparate collection of five commercial steamboats overlaid with iron plates, three timberclads that I had mentioned before, and the seven city-class ironclads became responsible for protecting this gaggle of transports. And the ironclads were the first vessels built by the United States government as ironclad vessels. They're built from the ground up as ironclads. And if you've looked at Civil War textbooks, that's kind of the classic picture that you see of a ironclad, like the USS Cairo is often featured. Southerners tried to slow the Union advance by choking off the river supply line and harassing the Mississippi Squadron. In June of 1862, the commander of the Confederates' Trans-Mississippi Department issued an order calling on all Southern men to organize themselves into military companies. Their duty, Brigadier General Thomas C. Hindman intoned, was to, quote, cut off federal pickets, scouts, foraging parties, and trains, and to kill pilots and others on gunboats and transports, attacking them day and night, end quote. So many men either heeded Hindman's orders or were motivated by their own desires that a Union officer complained that on the White River in Arkansas, quote, the transports were fired at very often from woods by guerrilla bands, end quote, between St. Charles and Clarendon. The situation was just as bad in Tennessee and Kentucky. In September of 1862, Alexander Pennock reported that the banks of the Ohio and Tennessee rivers were lined with guerrillas. And there's just more and more examples that I won't bore you with. Along the lower Mississippi River, Southern partisans were even more creative. They built gun platforms for artillery, sliced embrasures in the levees, and covered the openings with boards. Sharpshooters either stood on the levees or perched in trees. The commander of the USS Shota described the levee as, quote, a strong, safe, and ready-made breastwork for sharpshooters, end quote. When Union vessels or merchant ships steamed by, the attackers dropped the boards and started shooting. It seemed as if the very landscape came alive. We are now constantly under fire of the covert kind as we pass up and down the river, noted the commander of one boat. When Southern guerrillas attacked the USS Caneo near Donaldsonville, Louisiana, its commander ordered the boat to swing around and throw some shrapnel and grape at the ambushers. The cannonade only succeeded in driving off the attackers, who hauled away their four artillery pieces in a mad dash that exposed, quote, nothing except the tips of their horses' ears running away, sort of alluding to what you spoke about earlier today. The Union Navy was drawn into a deadly game of whack-a-mole. Confederate guerrillas would pop up from behind the levee in Louisiana or take pot shots from behind, I think William Sherman called it a stand of cottonwood trees, in Tennessee, and Northern sailors would try, often in vain, to smite them. This Confederate guerrilla offensive depended on favorable environmental conditions, to a degree. Abundant rains in the spring of 1862 unexpectedly gave way to a drought by early summer. Not only did crops wither, but the rivers in the West shrunk to mere trickles in some places. The Union's heavy timberclads and ironclads were poorly adapted to these low water levels. Comparing the water levels of 1862 to 63, Leroy Fitch, he was a gunboat commander, admitted that in the former year, quote, the river could not be patrolled as thoroughly as desired owing to low water and the scarcity of boats. Inadequate patrols put the Union supply line at risk. At the unfortunately named Duck River Sucks in Tennessee, and a suck was a natural feature where there was a rock formation and it would kind of pull things down into it. The transport W.B. Terry got stuck on a ledge of rocks when it misjudged how low the water had fallen. The boat remained in place overnight on August 30th and 31st of 1862. The next morning, about 200 guerrillas riddled the boat with musket fire and forced it to surrender. Kind of the idea of the opportunism that was talked about in the earlier panel, that there was a method to the madness, if you will. By contrast, the spring rains of 1863 limited the Confederate guerrilla war. The commander of the USS Conestoga wrote in March of that year that the riverbanks are now so overflowed that the guerrillas can give us but little trouble, end quote. While weather conditions did not determine the success or failure of Confederate guerrilla efforts, they certainly shifted the odds. The partisan war was also rooted in identifying favorable environmental locations. Southern guerrillas carefully chose places to stage their ambushes. The commander of the USS Cincinnati noted how lurking bands waited along the Mississippi River's tributaries, which are narrow streams, his words, with thick growth of timber on their borders. A peninsula jutting into the Mississippi River near its confluence with the Arkansas River became, quote, a very bad guerrilla station, end quote, from a hand-drawn map that I saw, because boats had to slow down when they rounded the trouble spot. And so you had the river kind of made this big turn like that, and it was about a 7-mile journey along, you know, as you're going on the outside, and it's a slower journey because of the way the water kind of shifts the banks, and so you only have it's not deep everywhere, and so you're kind of very specific places you have to go. And so basically the boats were kind of like a shooting gallery because the guerrillas could kind of follow along on the land. Winding rivers also contributed to boats' vulnerability. Guerrillas riding overland in more or less of a straight line could rouse men who then attacked the slow-moving boats. H.A. Glassford of the tin-clad USS Reindeer glumly reported how partisan bands attacked his boats at 5 different places as it steamed along the sinuous Cumberland River in Jackson County, Tennessee. And Confederates also chose high ground to rain fire down on Union vessels, and I've got some more examples. But anyway, Southern guerrillas studied the landscape and carefully chose ambush locations where they could use environmental conditions to turn the war in their favor, if at least for a short time. Such ambushes were so numerous and serious that they provoked a response from the Mississippi River Squadron. At first, individual commanders improvised, but the lack of a coherent policy prompted Porter to set the rules of engagement and provide clarity as to what and who would become the target of Union guns. Should a vessel be fired upon, Porter insisted, it was the captain's duty to, quote, fire back in spirit and destroy everything in that neighborhood within reach of his guns. The only way to stop guerrilla warfare, he continued, was to destroy houses that gave shelter to rebels. Should innocent people be harmed, so be it. Porter thought that such casualties would, quote, teach others that it will be to their advantage to inform the government authorities when guerrillas are about certain localities, end quote. Here we have one of the foundational documents for the Union's hard war strategy, and one that occurred as early and probably even earlier than the actions of the Army. Mark Grimsley has argued that the Union's hard war strategy emerged in the Western Theater in April of 1863 at the earliest. He characterizes the hard war as having 2 main attributes: actions against Southern civilians and property made expressly in order to demoralize Southern civilians and ruin the Confederate economy, and the allocation of substantial military resources to accomplish the job. What is striking to me, at least, about Grimsley's fine book is that it does not account for the actions of the Union Navy. Yeah, and another way to think about this panel is to paraphrase Abigail Adams. Instead of remember the ladies, it's remember the Navy. The Mississippi Squadron emerged in 1862 as one of the leaders of the hard war doctrine. In a letter to none other than William T. Sherman, Porter explained his rationale for carrying, quote, the war into the heart of the enemy's country. He wanted the Army and the Navy to, quote, give them the rebels, a taste of devastation that may bring them to their senses, end quote. And my gathering of the reading of Porter and Sherman is that they established a friendship. I mean, they saw the war the same way. The Navy needed a new class of gunboats to suppress this activity, and so it created what were called the tinclads. And so again, we have commercial steamboats that the Navy purchased. They purchased 67 of them, and they plated the upper portion of the boat with about 1-inch thick iron. It's not tin, it's iron, but they were meant to repel musket fire. They're no good against larger cannons, if you will. But they were intended to exert Union military power all across the Western River system. They were the Union High Command's response to the low water levels and guerrilla attacks. As one historian has noted, tinclads were like Viking ships that could appear anywhere, anytime, causing panic amongst civilians. The land that had been most valuable before the war was now the most vulnerable to Union attack. The Mississippi Squadron went to work with a vengeance. Sometimes the Navy confiscated only food that would be used to feed sailors, such as the time when Porter ordered the commander of the... Oops, got the wrong page. The USS Tyler to gather cattle, corn, chickens, turkeys, duck, geese, and eggs. But most often, those sailors expanded their sphere of destruction. The USS Fairplay confiscated 939 bags of wheat, 13 kegs of lard, 35 barrels of whiskey, great for sailors, one barrel of meat, one barrel of salt, 5 barrels of ale, and some boxes of groceries from the citizens of Caseyville, Kentucky, when someone in the vicinity attacked a mail steamer. Mail is an M-A-I-L. Likewise, the USS Forest Rose landed at Buck Island, Arkansas, and destroyed a house, storehouses, and the slave quarters of a planter who was suspected of sheltering guerrillas. For good measure, the sailors took off slaves, horses, mules, bacon, blankets, shovels, barrows, barrels of molasses, and sacks of corn. The USS Rattler and the USS Cricket visited Argyle's Landing in Mississippi as, quote, retaliation for the destruction of steamers, end quote. While the boats provided protection for a line of skirmishers, 10 scorchers raised the mansions, outhouses, gins, barns, and Negro quarters on the two plantations. The list of actions is nearly endless if you go through the OR, which I've done. When the Union Navy denuded riverside farms and plantations of food, it was not only punishing disloyal Southerners, it was degrading the ability of guerrillas to sustain themselves. Confederate guerrillas were either local citizens or were transients who depended on local civilians for shelter and or food. Each calorie from a riverside farm or plantation that found its way onto a Union boat was one less calorie that a Southern guerrilla or his horse could consume. But I don't say that in jest. I say it as something very important. It's not in my original remarks, but it made me rethink that a little bit. When Union sailors took this food, they tried to target known Confederate sympathizers. Sims Brown, a sailor on the USS Tyler, described to his fiancée how he and his men from his boat, quote, helped ourselves to what sweet potatoes and corn meals we wanted and dressed a beef, in other words, slaughtered a cow. They raided the plantation of a man named Diamond who had supposedly helped in the attack on a Union transport. When the same boat stopped at another plantation 2 weeks later with the expectation of doing the same thing, the owner provided a certificate of protection from a Union general. As Brown explained it, we disturbed nothing, of course. The Union's actions are perfectly comprehensible, but it became nearly impossible to restrain the sailors from inflicting vengeance on Southerners, some of whom were loyal to the Union, and others who had withdrawn their support from the Confederacy. You can't sort out active opponents, passive people who just wanted the war to the end, and Unionists, in other words. After Porter authorized the hard war, one sailor on the USS Tyler seemed overjoyed. After shelling Ashley's Landing in Arkansas and burning a number of buildings there, Sims Brown wrote, "We have opened the ball. What the Union had really opened was a can of worms, because it proved impossible to calibrate the violence or to differentiate between Southerners who were hostile and those who were loyal." These tensions can be seen in the Navy's attack on Palmyra, Tennessee, on April 6, 1863. After guerrillas crippled the USS St. Clair, Alexander Pennock sent 5 boats to find the perpetrators. Sailors landed at Palmyra, quote, one of the worst secession places on the river, according to one captain. While sailors burned, quote, every house in the place, they also had strict orders, quote, not to pillage or remove the smallest article. They didn't. In practice, it proved impossible to prevent such theft. The acting master and an ensign on the USS Mound City were court-martialed for pillaging houses and stealing china, boxes, trunks, and even an ivory crucifix. Things got so bad that the Secretary of the Navy ordered an investigation to determine if the sole object of the Mississippi Squadron was plunder. For his part, Porter tried to rein in the thievery, but he also redirected the allegations toward the Mississippi Marine Brigade. Originally created as a ram fleet, that's a whole other set of steamboats designed to be rams, you know, to puncture the other side's boat. The Confederacy had some as well. Surprisingly effective. The Mississippi Marine Brigade was an independent unit that eventually became a counterinsurgency strike force. It was supposed to chase down Confederate guerrillas, but by 1863, the brigade's men established a reputation for indiscriminate plunder. They basically had a squad of men, both on foot and on horseback, that would just dismount and then go after the guerrillas. Their actions became so egregious that eventually the Navy had to deactivate the unit. A cotton mania broke down discipline even more. Cotton had a legitimate military purpose. Sailors stuffed it into gunboats as a way to shore up weak spots and protect boilers. And Porter envisioned that the confiscation and sale of cotton would not only hurt the Confederate war effort, but help defray the war's costs. Sailors had a different idea. For them, it was a get-rich-quick scheme. You know, cotton was the single most important commodity in the United States on the eve of the Civil War, the most valuable export for the United States as well. Since they could share in the profits from confiscated cotton, sailors invented all sorts of methods to ensure that all cotton was deemed enemy property, even if taken from Southern Unionists. Crewmen stenciled CSA on all cotton they seized and then properly marked USN on the reverse side of the bale. The rules on confiscation were so routinely flouted that one Army colonel groused that CSA USN stood for Cotton Stealing Association of the United States Navy. This massive confiscation hindered naval operations. Sailors stuffed cotton in tin-clad holds, sometimes making the boats too heavy to float. And things were so bad that the captain of the USS Rattler tried to sell his boat to the Confederates for $250,000 and 100 bales of cotton. Despite the plundering, poor discipline, and cotton mania, the Mississippi Squadron was able to carry out a hard war against Southern civilians. In doing so, it complemented the activities of the Union land forces. Lisa Brady's argued that Grant's Army of the Tennessee, tried to exert control over the environment during his campaign to take Vicksburg. Grant used a number of strategies, including a failed plan to reroute the Mississippi River and a successful series of raids that attacked the region's agricultural productivity. She's certainly correct, but Union naval strategy was more than just controlling the land or turning it back into a wilderness, which is one of her central arguments. The Union Navy tried to detach the Confederate war effort from the fruits of the land. The constant patrolling of tinclads along the western waters limited the Confederacy's ability to use agricultural produce from Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas to feed its armies in the eastern and western theaters. The Union Navy tightened a noose around the Confederacy. Porter issued General Order No. 21 that explicitly outlined the Union strategy to deny the Confederacy the fruits of the land. He directed commanders of all vessels to prevent any unauthorized commerce and to, quote, break up the carrying of anything into rebel ports, end quote. Now, it didn't always work, and, you know, it was kind of like the blockade. It was leaky, but, you know, it still had some effect. Suddenly, cotton, clothing, food, shoes, salt, saddles, medicines, and munitions were contraband. Union boats were, in the words of one Union commander, constantly scouring the river, end quote, looking for scofflaws. As we've seen, the Mississippi Squadron seized, you know, wheat, lard, whiskey, etc., encouraged slaves to run away, a whole other story, and generally delighted in tormenting Southern civilians. The crew of the USS Benton reveled in throwing some shells above a herd of cattle and frightening the poor beasts, which presumably were intended to be converted into Confederate calories because they were trying to get them across the river. Union gunboats contributed to the lack of supplies and low morale in Southern armies in the last couple years of the war. The Navy also turned the environment against the Confederacy. The commander of the USS Conestoga neutralized that very bad guerrilla station that I had mentioned earlier and drew the very bad air map about by digging a new channel for the Mississippi River. That the cutoff allowed the Union boats to travel quickly in a straight line for half a mile rather than a slow journey of 10 miles meant that Confederate guerrillas had fewer opportunities to take pot shots at the Navy. So basically, as the river went like this, they just cut it straight and made an oxbow. Ironclads also wrecked the levee. In March of 1862, Captain Thomas Selfridge of the USS Conestoga steamed to Bolivar, Mississippi, and cut 50 feet of the levee. His purpose? Quote, drown out Mrs. Monley and old Top. While the identity of Monley and Top are unclear, it's obvious that my time is nearly up. So we'll just cut to the chase. But basically, essentially, Southern planters had worked for years or forced their slaves to work for years to create a system that drew sustenance and wealth from the land. Union gunboats interrupted or destroyed this complex system and thereby sapped the Confederate ability to sustain the war. Porter, in his usual direct fashion, summed it up this way. Starvation only will bring these people to their senses. And so my main point is to, when we think about guerrillas and the hard war, we also need to bring the environment into our studies. Thank you. This is my souvenir for the day. Thank you.
Thank you all for being in attendance and for allowing me to talk about the blockade this morning. So let's dive in. Most discussions of the Union blockade during the Civil War inevitably devolve to the argument of whether or not it succeeded. Traditional back-and-forth arguments have involved dissections of capture rates, successful runs, and the amount of goods which slipped through in endless statistical forms. Marcus Price argues that the blockade's success lay in its mere existence, which deterred many ships and companies from even risking a run. There's also the argument that the blockade's success lay in its psychological impact on the Confederacy. However, one aspect of the blockade remains markedly absent from most discussions: the role of the blockade in the Union's hard war policy. Certainly, the object of the blockade was to limit the entrance of military supplies, but it also hurt the Confederate economy as well. The effect of all of this is that the necessities needed by the civilian populace was also reduced. And while it may not have been the intention of the Lincoln administration for the blockade to affect civilians in such a drastic way, that was its most lasting effect. In his work, The Hard Hand of War, Mark Grimsley states the two main attributes which underline classic hard war operations. And I will not repeat them since we've just heard them. He says that these attributes only surfaced in the Western theater in 1863 and much later in the East, and on the coast. If these attributes are foundational for judging hard war policy, the blockade fulfilled both of these requirements early in the war. If not within the first year, then certainly by the bombardment of Charleston on August 12, 1863. It's true, the bombardment came from the Army, but that does not lessen the blockade as the vehicle for hard war policy. Grimsley went on to break down the hard war policy into three phases, which led from conciliation to a middle ground, and finally to the Union's ultimate hard war policy. However, he completely neglected naval aspects, and more specifically, the blockade in the treatment. When compared side by side with Sherman's activities or Pope's special orders in the Valley, the blockade's activities appear very light. But herein lies the reality of the blockade's hard war activities. There were consequences of indirect rather than direct actions. Announced by Lincoln on April 19, 1861, the blockade was an integral part of Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan. Though never truly adopted, the plan provided the framework for the Union's military policy. Scott's strategy appealed to the belief that a strong pro-Union sentiment existed in the South, and all that was needed was to cut off the Confederacy's line of supply and present a large enough force to foment that pro-Union sentiment into a counter-revolution. While this seems to confirm Grimsley's assertions that the first part of the war involved a lack of hard war measures, it ignores the blockade's purpose of depriving the Confederacy of supply. Scott's plan relied on this deprivation to promote internal unrest and show that the Confederate government and economy could not provide for its citizens. The import-export economy was extremely important for southern states, as it lacked a strong industrial base, and Great Britain relied on the South's cotton exports for its mills. Because of this, the Confederacy held a strong belief that Great Britain would intervene on their behalf, and at the least either ignore the blockade or determine that it was illegal. This was one of the earliest problems faced by the Lincoln administration involving the blockade. Lincoln faced a dilemma with the announcement of a blockade because he adamantly maintained that the Confederacy had no standing as a sovereign nation. But a blockade appeared to many as a de facto recognition of sovereign status. The threat of a blockade worried Britain because of its need for southern cotton, to a point where Britain's foreign commissioner to the United States, Lord Lyons, threatened Secretary of State William Seward with British recognition of the Confederacy if an interruption of Britain's cotton supply occurred. Such bluster did not stop the blockade from moving forward, however, and by late 1861, workers in Britain began to blame the Union blockade instead of Confederate embargoes on cotton for the impending crisis. While this may not appear as a true product of Union hard war policy, it cannot be ignored simply because of its occurrence in Britain and not against the Confederacy. Of course, this was not the only problem the British had with the blockade. In December 1861, the Union Navy embarked upon another action, sinking ships at the mouths of harbor to block ships from entering and leaving. Named the Stone Fleet, these ships aroused the ire of British populace, newspapers, and even the Foreign Office. The London Times believed that, quote, among the crimes which have disgraced the history of mankind, it would be difficult to find one more atrocious than this. While the Foreign Office believed such an action could only be adopted as a measure of revenge and irremediable injury against the enemy. So there's this international recognition that there is an early aspect to this hard war policy coming from the Navy. These words and actions certainly underscored the trade relationship and that recognition of hard war policy. Without a strong industrial base, the Confederacy relied on Britain and other nations for all sorts of goods during the war and even before the war. Prior to the war, southern manufacturing firms represented just 14.7% of the nation's total, while those products represented only 8.2% of the nation's total manufacturing value. The majority of southern exports centered on staple goods, and though the amount of total goods imported from foreigners was small, it does not take into account goods imported from northern states. Several states even imported a majority of their grain. The same was true of salt, as Virginia, producing nearly 2 million bushels per year, did not supply near enough for the Confederacy. Indeed, Virginia produced twice the amount of wheat of any southern state and also half the value of flour and meal. The Confederacy could not have been more ill-prepared for a prolonged war if they had tried. However, the long-term problem came in the form of civilian goods. Seemingly ordinary items such as needles, coffee, tea, etc., became rare and expensive commodities. And while Southerners adjusted and created usable replacements, it was in the capacity of limiting consumer goods which the blockade excelled. Some of the most glaring arguments against the blockade's effectiveness come from studies of capture rates and the amounts of goods which passed through. The rising cost of consumer goods in the Confederate states made blockade running a lucrative endeavor for those with an adventurous spirit, and made the smuggling of consumer goods a greater priority than the smuggling of military goods. Still, the amount of smuggled goods could not compete with the demands of the populace or the military, and such a lack of goods was not lost on the public. As early as summer 1861, diarist Mary Boykin Chestnut noted that the army begins to cry out for more ammunition, and already the blockade is beginning to shut it all out. Inflation, too, ran rampant as the war progressed, dramatically raising prices of goods as real wages remained the same. Blame for this settled on blockade runners and speculators who dealt in high-priced goods. But this anger can be traced back to the blockade. Fear of the blockade's effect on the public emanated from the government as well. War Department clerk John Jones, after purchasing set of clothes, wrote, quote, "What will be the price of such commodities a year hence if the blockade continues?" The blockade posed a real and visible threat, one that threatened the daily civilian life along with the life of the military. It is no wonder, then, that Mary Boykin Chestnut wrote, "Thank God for a ship. It has run the blockade with arms and ammunition." Such language also brings to light not just the physical effect of the blockade and its realities, but the psychological effect as well. In December 1863, Ella Gertrude Clanton Thomas told her children that there would be no Christmas because, quote, "Santa Claus has not been able to run the blockade." For a child, this must have seemed a devastating blow, and all due to the Union blockade. Whether or not the blockade itself was responsible for the lack of goods, it provided an easy scapegoat for those looking to place blame for material deficiencies. For those who grew up in southern port cities, the blockade provided a constant reminder of the presence of the enemy. At any moment, shelling could occur or an invasion might come. The blockade provided the catalyst for Southerners' fears to run wild simply due to its existence. At another point in her diary, Mary Boykin Chestnut refers to the blockade as, quote, "a stockade which hems us in, only the sky open to us." This usage suggested a belief that the blockade had turned their world into a prison, letting in and out only small amounts of goods. Some goods did manage to make it through into civilian hands, but a general lack of goods created a dilemma for a large portion of the populace. The blockade had such a psychological impact on the populace that any successful attempt at a run boosted spirits. Again, Mary Boykin Chestnut stated that a steamer's successful run at Savannah made citizens raise our wilted heads like flowers after a shower. Civilians bore the brunt of the blockade and experienced its repercussions daily, but common soldiers, too, recognized its potency. In his memoirs, Confederate Private William A. Fletcher tells of his experiences in the Confederate Army. After the Battle of Fredericksburg, Fletcher noted the dead soldiers who had been stripped of their clothes and other belongings. The work, he said, was not done by soldiers except in times of necessity, but by those who make a business of it, as the clothing, when washed, was good stock in secondhand stores. This clothing supplied needy civilians and soldiers who could not afford anything better. Certainly, the people purchasing these goods knew or at least suspected where the clothing came from. It was to measures such as these that the populace was forced to go. Few, if any, people would willingly resort to wearing clothing formerly on a dead body. Fletcher placed the blame for these actions squarely on the blockade. Nobody stopped the practice nor saw any harm because, quote, "the party stripped was a party to blockading our ports, which created the urgent necessity." Any niceties previously allowed the dead was no longer required because the blockade created desperate needs in the Confederacy. These psychological and physical effects were directly fomented by the blockade, but other, more subtle effects display the extent of the blockade and its involvement in hard war policy. In August 1861, the Union captured Fort Hatteras in North Carolina, and in November of the same year captured Port Royal Sound in a joint venture between the Army and the Navy. Port Royal's capture gave Union forces a base of operations deep in enemy territory from which to maintain the blockade and maintain a threatening land force. Following up this success, the Union commander, Samuel DuPont, sent gunboats up some of the rivers as far as they could go, destroying bridges and convoying Army troops to most of the sea islands. These occupations closed other navigable waters to blockade runners, thereby depriving Confederate civilians of even more goods that were making it through the blockade. Almost immediately, civilians living on the sea islands fled, leaving most of their belongings in some of the richest areas in South Carolina. This flight and a loss of the majority of their worldly possessions certainly felt like hard war to these inhabitants. After the Union's occupation of Albemarle Sound, General Ambrose Burnside sent out detachments to help Union sympathizers and harass Confederate supply lines. On February 19, 1862, a Union brigade performing these tasks was ambushed by Confederate troops. The next day, after landing at the town of Winton and discovering its use as a Confederate storehouse, the brigade set fire to the town and pillaged its buildings. While the Army carried out the act, the Navy and blockade were its catalysts. The same is true of the bombardment of Charleston by the Swamp Angel Battery on Morris Island. It was through the actions of the blockade that these occupied areas along the Confederate coast were taken and maintained. The Navy provided the groundwork for these inland incursions, which were feared by Confederates along the coast. Of course, the Confederacy offered some resistance to the blockade, but this resistance helped contribute to the hard war. To counter the blockade, the Confederacy relied upon Secretary of the Navy Stephen Mallory's ideas of ironclad ships armed with large caliber guns. Unfortunately, a lack of iron necessitated scavenging from many sources, including little used rail lines. This had consequences later in the war, but to break the blockade or even attempt to damage it, certain sacrifices were needed. Additionally, the blockade preempted other forms of transportation. Any movement along the coast for trade or troop transport was too risky except for the most local of movements. Confederate designs at such notions were quickly tabled as blockading ships grew more numerous by the day. All of this put an even greater stress on a fragile railroad infrastructure. By the start of Grant's Petersburg campaign, the Confederacy's internal transportation system fell apart, keeping much-needed supplies in the Deep South from leaching Lee's army and civilian populations located in Virginia. Another side effect of the blockade was the need for Confederate forces to maintain a military presence along the coast to discourage too much raiding by Union forces and to give blockade runners help in making it to port. This used precious manpower and war material needed in other theaters. The blockade commandeered Confederate resources simply because it existed and helped bring about internal problems for Confederate infrastructure, problems which hurt civilians just as much as the military later on in the war. By the end of 1863, the Union Navy and blockade had already implemented a hard war strategy on the Confederacy. To be sure, the process itself was drawn out and involved many pieces indirectly, but that does not limit the blockade's importance on hard war strategy. Directly, the blockade limited the amount of consumer goods as well as military goods which entered into Confederate ports. Exports of cotton and other products vital to Confederate trade were hemmed in as well. This caused runaway inflation and stressed the already overused railway system. Indirectly, the blockade was responsible for the maintenance of Union soldiers along the Confederate coast and forced the Confederacy to maintain adequate troops in coastal regions. The blockade's impact was also felt overseas as thousands of British workers found themselves unemployed due to a lack of cotton. Though this affected Britain and not the Confederacy, it must still be included because it was a side effect of the blockade's hard war tactics. It is easy to dismiss the blockade's contribution to the Union's hard war policy, and its place is foundational because of the extent of the evolution of the eventual hard war policy. Nevertheless, the blockade should not be overlooked. The experiences of those living with the blockade attest to its effect physically and psychologically on hard war policy. Helping to lay the foundation for the Union's eventual hard war policy, the blockade demonstrated an ability to reach beyond direct action and affect multiple areas. It is in this capacity that the blockade stands out. Before Sherman cemented hard war legacy, the blockade set precedent in measures for hard war. Instead of viewing the blockade in terms of its success or lack thereof against blockade runners, it is imperative to look beyond the numbers and see the extent of the blockade's imprint on hard war policy and the war in general. Thank you.
So it's my great pleasure now to introduce the commenter for these papers. Robert Bonner has his doctorate from Yale University. He is professor and chair of the history department at Dartmouth College, where he teaches classes on the American Civil War, 19th century politics, and the transatlantic age of emancipation. His publications include Colors of Blood, Flag Passions of the Confederate South, The Soldier's Pen, First-Hand Impressions of the American Civil War, and Mastering America, Southern Slaveholders and the Crisis of American Nationhood. He is currently researching the geopolitics of American slavery and writing a biography of Alexander Stephens. Great. Welcome, Professor Bonner.
I was in a bit of a panic earlier. I thought I was going to have to learn everything interesting about these commenters and have then throw one in that was clever of my own. So I don't think that's my responsibility. But we should find out about the one that was false about everyone in the first panel at some point. I look forward to that. Anyway, thank you very much for including me here. I hope to learn even more than I've learned so far. I learned a lot from these papers. I've learned a lot from the first panel. Let me begin the comments that I've put together. And again, you set a high bar in terms of providing comments beforehand. I haven't done that. I hope to. I've written comments in depth about each of these papers. But as I see it, one of the things, at least from the titles and from what I've heard so far, is the conference as a whole is seeking the alternative to the battlefield, thinking about other sort of spatial dimensions of violence during this period. The way in which we can imagine alternative modes of violence, I think, is at the center of thinking about irregular war and involving civilian costs here. What does war look like away from the battlefield in sort of the big terms? I think one of the takeaways when we move away from the battlefield, which is such a tightly structured space and so highly commemorative in the years since, we get a deeper sense, I think, of the fundamental political nature of the war, and by that I mean sort of the Clausewitzian sense of war being politics by other means. I think it reminds us that violence is an implement of something larger on the part of the federal government, which is seeking to restore authority through invasion and occupation, and that the fundamental political goal of the Confederacy is to resist that. To frustrate the goal of restoring federal authority by maintaining Confederate territorial supremacy and the integrity of this new state. I think Mark Grimsley's book does a pretty good job of that in terms of sort of thinking about hard war as a part of that larger political set of objectives and the way in which over time, in a series of stages that people have mentioned before, what needed to be done to accomplish those political objectives change as certain experiments don't get the job done. So I look forward to hearing about all sorts of different sites in which this is taking place. Households, private farms, frontiers, borders, the state of Kentucky, which is the next panel. These are all marginal areas in the same way that the maritime case studies that we have today are. We'll also see, I think, later on and how certain legal modes and memory operates differently in some of these spaces than they do on the battlefield. Let me turn to the maritime locales that we're hearing about here, and it is nice to do it in this sort of staged area where we're surrounded by all of these vessels. Naval operations have all long been sort of an add-on to our account of federal military objectives. Lincoln did so in his nod to, somewhat embarrassing nod really, to Uncle Sam's web feet, where he located the Union naval efforts at all the watery margins. This was in his letter to Conkling. I think what these papers suggest is that those marginal spaces are really quite interesting, and in some ways perhaps the central front of certain activity. In the papers, we've heard about saboteurs and manliness from Laura Davis. We've heard about the environmental damage and factors in the Brownwater War of the Mississippi Valley. We've heard about the blockade's ability to inflict damage at a very early stage. What I'd like to do is to make a couple of links between these projects, then to sort of pull back and to to think about some other issues, and then to, depending on time, to make a couple of specific comments. I know I don't want to keep us from lunch. Laura and Robert both take us into the Brown Water War, particularly the Mississippi River Valley, which, as they, I think, have really quite convincingly showed, did not flow unvexed to the sea after the fall of Vicksburg. We hear an argument that I think is extraordinarily important, and one that really is echoed between the papers about the blockade and about the Brown Water War, about precedence here. Did the hard war begin in the maritime war mode? And I think that's something that we need to think about. All three of the papers, though, do bring us into focus a central question that I'd like to explore just with a little bit of thoroughness, which is what is meaningful about the maritime realm when it comes to attacks on property and persons? This is a space, I would suggest, that does involve a different set of basic orientations than the land war. And let me just sort of tick through some of that. Water is the commons with open access, and that's true both of the international domain of the high seas and for the kinds of arteries that we're talking about in terms of the Mississippi River. During peace, it's the preeminent zone of economic exchange. That continues to be the case. A recent book about the supercargoes reminds us that 90% of everything comes to us over oceanic space. Certainly true in the 19th century. In peacetime, it was the zone of economic exchange. In wartime, it was the zone of logistical support. And so its crucial role as part of the infrastructure of just the basic means of fighting this war have to be underscored. I think each of these papers do that, but I'd like to just remind us of how important it is for the status of property and persons on the water for any sort of effort to accomplish war aims. Now, given that, waterborne property in particular, and that's what I'd like to think about for just a moment, is always in transit in terms of being sort of merchandisable. And this has led, by this point, to a certain set of conventions, particularly on the high seas, in terms of prize courts, in terms of the vulnerability of property to be seized during times of war, that is much more sort of regulated, but also much more open than is the case of land war. So the notion that property is more vulnerable when it's on a boat than it is on the land is a function of that understanding of the economic distribution between countries. Some of that seems to echo in terms of the river operations. Capture of cotton seems to be part of this prize mentality. And so partly what the genealogy that I see working here is perhaps maybe a set of convention that comes from sort of the high seas prize court mentality in which sailors are going to sea really for profit. It's very different than any sort of land forces. They're going knowing that any sort of capture they make will end up with cash in their pocket. If that mentality sort of comes into the Brown Water War just for the basis of these sailors did have earlier experience in the world of the prize courts, maybe that's the transit that we're talking about occurring here. There's also the realization that in terms of inflicting damage on particularly transport vehicles, that there's going to be a multiplier effect here, and I think all three of these papers do a pretty good job of thinking about that. Let me make a couple of specific points about Laura's paper. She says at one point that this is a paper that deals with masculinity, and she says categorically these are all men, but later in the paper she does sort of suggest that maybe she just hasn't found the women. I'd like to push her on that. There are lots of women in this piece, wives, brothel keepers, and so forth. So how that has to do with the sort of masculinization of this project is something that I think could stand being a little bit more spun out. On a similar note, there is a mention really early on in this paper about a Negro incendiary, and that sort of just goes away as well. Not as well, but we don't hear much about sort of the racial dimensions of that. Or the more basic
problem of what we're thinking about in terms of irregular warfare within a slave society. And that's probably something that the conference as a whole probably will begin to pick up on. As we move into the next paper, Robert Gudemstad's paper, we also hear a little bit about whites and blacks being treated differently, that there is an order at the very first opening anecdote, you know, fire upon any white person. We can sort of spin that out in terms of sort of a biracial river culture and what that means for the development of hard war there. As I shift and think a little bit more about his effort, I would encourage him, I've already mentioned this to him, to think about this ArcGIS stuff. This seems to be exactly the sort of thing that can be mapped effectively by some of the technologies we've heard about before. The episode about the Cotton Stealing Association does, I think, draw into question this notion of the vulnerability of property. One of the things about the hard war that I think we should do is draw a distinction between the vulnerability of property and the vulnerability of persons. Sometimes in this paper, those things kind of get mixed up, and maybe in our understanding of the hard war, those things get mixed up. They're kept very different in terms of any sort of maritime prize activity on the high seas, and maybe that's also going to be a case of the riverine operations as well. Finally, I'll move to Blakely Hill's work on the blockade. Here is an effort that plays for, I think, really big stakes here. Its impact is kind of on the second-order influence of the blockade. We sort of don't see a lot of the blockading activity in the nitty-gritty in terms of what it means for boats to be attacking other boats and so forth, but we do get a really palpable sense of the wide-ranging ramifications of that. One point I would like to make is that the attention that you draw to the Stone Fleet, I think, does remind us of something important, which is that if we make that distinction between the sanctity of property and the sanctity of persons, it really is the sanctity of property that the rest of the world cares about in terms of how the American Civil War impacts the maritime trade. The whole notion of a commercial blockade is controversial at this point. In 1856, the Declaration of Paris had sort of seemed to have tightened up the ability to impose blockades, and it had curtailed privateering among signatory states. So the reason that the world cares about the Stone Fleet is not because it's going to inflict suffering on civilians. It really is because it's an assault upon global commerce. And that, I think, is important to differentiate, again, within this larger context, to try to think about the hard war and how it disrupts property relations on the one hand, how it inflicts personal damage against human beings on the other. This is an age in which this one is oftentimes more important than that one, at least internationally. So with those somewhat, you know, sort of all over the place comments, I will allow us to have a few questions here. Do you want to call on people? Okay, sure. I'm up here since we'll save time. So I don't know. I can maybe tell from the organizers how much, when we should cut it off. Yeah.
I had sort of a quick multi-part question for Laura. The idea of this new strain of martial manhood based on sort of a comparative relationship where land-based guerrillas are sort of flamboyant,
yeah,
fame seekers, and naval guerrillas are sort of this faceless group has been saying terror, and the facelessness of it is really what makes it so terrifying. But in that regard, in your paper, you cite Quantrill and Anderson, who might be the least representative of the average bushwhacker in terms of how flamboyant and fame-seeking they are. So I'm wondering, on one hand, what you're using as sort of a baseline for defining a land-based bushwhacker within that comparison, but then also if the land-based guerrillas end up looking a lot like this, is that something actually very valuable about land guerrillas?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think in general, as we've been learning, it's hard to have a good baseline for the land-based guerrillas as opposed to my characters. And I think I chose Blakely Hill Anderson because they are so flamboyant, and that we have these flamboyant examples. And that in general, there seems to be a little bit more public awareness, public state of who some of these people are, and when we don't have the naval land guerrillas are, and that who are they really? Are they the guy next door and we don't know? Are we claiming they're the guy next door because we're mad at him for about something else? So I do think there is an interesting question overall about irregular warfare and what does that mean for masculinity? If you are not part of an official roster the way that you are, you've enlisted in the Union Army or anything. So I do think you're right in suggesting that there could be some interesting parallels there. I think above all, more than I see in the land-based stuff, and I'm not as well-versed in the land-based world as many of you are, the guys that I focus, the naval worlds I focus on, truly like don't even want to admit like they're a part of it, right? It's this big secret. And so it's trying to really figure out who they are and how do we get at them. And that the only time somebody is really admitting that they have participated is when they've been called in front of the provost marshal or supposedly maybe on their deathbed, if we believe the story. Right? So it's not even like their friends are talking about it. There's an extra layer of secrecy. But I think, just like some of their land-based counterparts, not everybody's speaking games.
No, I think you have a valid point, and sorry to steal a follow-up. How much of that do you think is a logistical necessity? If you're a boat burner, you have to be in one of, what, six major port towns to have access. If you burn a boat and you're out at the first time, you can never be a boat burner again.
Exactly. And so I do think a lot of it's necessity, and that's why most of these fires, when they happen at dock, seem to happen in the dead of night when it's very dark for the wee hours. So you can just kind of sneak in, set your fire, sneak back out. Sometimes you're setting fire to the same boat because it takes a couple times for the fire to take. But there are cases where they are on board. Supposedly with the Robert Campbell fire, the incendiary was on board, and so he placed whatever explosive device he did, and that's why it caught fire midstream. So they are at times risking their lives, but more often than not, they like to take a safer way out and set fire when the ship's at dock. Plus, it's more productive that way. You set fire in one boat, it's docked next to six others, they're all going up, and you can invoke more.
Eric Morgan, I'm a grad student at the University of Missouri. I have a question for Laura as well. With commerce raiding on the high seas, you know, the Alabama, the Shenandoah, et cetera, it kind of has an exaggerated effect after the war, but jacking up shipping insurance to kind of magnificent rates. I was wondering, with regard to the riverine aspects, did you notice anything in your research that would maybe kind of give them an excess impact after the war with regard to shipping rates
and
insurance?
That's a great question, and I get that a lot. And I have not been able to find that many cases about the insurance claims about these ships. So I have not specifically noticed a raise. I mean, insurance rates for steamboat vessels are kind of anyway because of their innate combustibility. Anyway, but it's something that I keep trying to find, and I just haven't found it. But it seems to be a logical conclusion. I have no evidence either way.
Michael?
Yes. David Dixon Porter, William Tecumseh Sherman, the tag team that won the war, discussed.
it sounds like a throwdown.
No, it's actually my personal opinion.
Yeah, so. as I alluded to, you know, they seem to exchange more than just dear sir, please send troops or please send steamboat here, whatever, you know. It goes beyond that. They seem to be on the same level of understanding of how they wanted to win the war and what it took to win the war in terms of going after civilians. And so it appears, again, from the limited correspondence that I've read, that they just clicked or connected, and then they have kind of these personal glimpses that you see in correspondence beyond just kind of the official duties. And so, I don't want to have people say, well, you know, like Sherman learned from Porter because, you know, Porter comes first and then Sherman puts these things into place. But I think their ideas kind of co-evolve as, Sherman has to cooperate very closely with Porter, during the campaign for Vicksburg. And so, you know, they're kind of learning from one another, and then Sherman can apply sort of the things that he's been talking about with Porter in a different area.
We have time for one more question, and if we could make it about the blockade, that would be great.
Since we haven't had anyone is burning to have a question for Blakely.
Well, I have a question about the blockade, and it has to do with you You're interesting to me. I hadn't thought about that distinction between personal property and property, basically. And the comment that your discussion of the blockade seems to focus more on harm to civilians. And in general, to me, it raised the question of what is hard war anyway? I mean, and I'm inclined to think that hard war is when you cross lines into the civilian population. But a lot of this discussion of hard war seems unmoored from that. You know, it's about military tactics. And so I'm wondering, I guess it's a question for you, but it could be a question for the whole panel, which is how do you think we should define hard war in light of the blockade?
That's actually the question, you know, that brought probably around to writing this. I'm not really sure, actually. I mean, I'm not sure that that's a bad thing because everyone understands hard war in a different way, almost. And I heard a quote one time. Someone said, you know, hard war is when your neighbor's house is burned down. Total war is when your house is burned down. And you know, is there a difference in that? I mean, I think there is a military aspect of it. Like, it doesn't, it's not, I think there's a blurring of lines in hard war policy, and it should be. It's not just when it crosses over into civilians. I think that.
Maybe someone should do a book like Elizabeth Barron wrote a book about disunion, and I swear the way that she wrote it was she searched all the newspapers for the word disunion. So someone should do a similar search, and we should search everything for hard war, and we should see how they actually used it at the time.
Do you want to give the announcement about what we're doing next?
I certainly will. Naval War panelists, thank you very much. All right, we're going to take a break for lunch. Lunch will be downstairs in the dining room where the coffee...